Welcome, all, and some people who may be coming for the first time in this class series. I think hopefully you can pick up on the gist of this Dogen piece as we delve back into the middle of it here, because each section includes the whole. Always with Dogen, it is such. So we're to the paragraph that starts, "A fish swims in the ocean." So on these photocopies, it's the second paragraph on the second page. We heard some metaphors about the circle of water. So there's like the ocean, and you're in the circle, in the middle of an ocean, and it looks like there's just a circle of water, but actually there's all these features on the shore that we can't see. And then there's the moon is reflected, even in a puddle an inch wide or in a drop of water. So there's a lot of water imagery, which is nice on a rainy night in Santa Cruz. And now we're gonna get into fish swimming in the water. Different water metaphors, but it's kind of nice to have the same water imagery, because water can be seen in all these different ways, as Dogen points out. Fish see water differently than humans, for example. So here we start, "A fish swims in the ocean, and no matter how far it swims, there is no end to the water. A bird flies in the sky, and no matter how far it flies, there is no end to the air. However, the fish and the bird have never left their elements. When their activity is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. Thus, each of them totally covers its full range, and each of them totally experiences its realm." Fish and bird swimming through their elements. And as a metaphor, we could take this in many different ways, and people do interpret it in different ways. The way that Kaz Ta-Nehisi and Robert Aiken, in this translation, a footnote somewhere, they look at it as that the fish and the bird are the practitioner. Those are the beings practicing, swimming through practice. And the water and air are practice that they swim through. Or we could even say zazen, or we could say daily life, whatever we think of as our practice, that's our realm. And and then later, life is, you know, water is life and the bird is life. So life could be looked at as the verification. So we'll get into that. But for now, it's the bird and the fish, the practitioner, swimming through their life of practice, and in zazen, swimming through this life of zazen. And when their activity is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. So if we're thinking of zazen in this way, we might have a kind of when we have a dull, sleepy mind, zazen, our field of practice might be kind of small. Yeah, this is one way I kind of take it, is that the range of the mind of us in the practice, it doesn't reach that far. It's completely filling the realm of sleepy zazen. You know, in sleepy zazen, there's just sleepy zazen, and ultimately we don't judge that that's worse than wide awake, clear, alert zazen. In the end, in this realm of Genjo Koan, it's like at that time, that's our full range of practice, is this like limited, the murky edges of our realm of practice. If you can remember that image of when you're sitting in sleepy zazen, it feels like we don't go very far. It's limited. We are, and we arouse a little concentration. Okay, sit up, right, a little bit, and just, you know, extend our awareness a little bit further, and then we do that for about 3 seconds, and then we're like, oh yeah, what am I, oh yeah, it's a zazen here. Like our circle of water is kind of small, but we're totally filling its realm. It's complete practice at that time. And then there might be a time when, you know, at the end of a long sesshin, where we're totally settled into the ocean of zazen that seems vast and boundless, and like we could swim forever in this water or air of present awareness. And at that time, it's like our activity is large, so the field needs to be large. The mind is alert, so that the realm of zazen has got to be large to encompass that, because we're never going to reach its boundaries in any case. And these two situations would be ultimately not different. You know, they're, each of them are totally complete and fill their realm in that way. And Shohaku Okamura Roshi brings up in his commentary, he says he's sure that this fish and bird metaphor comes from Hongzhi's poem about zazen called Zazen Xin. There's a poem called Zazen Xin that this Chinese ancestor Hongzhi, who lived a couple hundred years, maybe 100 years before Dogen in China, wrote about poetically expressing zazen practice. And then Dogen wrote an essay called Zazen Xin, commenting on this poem and other Zen stories about zazen. Zazen Xin, in this case, means Xin is the acupuncture needle of zazen, or of sitting meditation. So this is this poem, and then Dogen's essay commenting on it, are an acupuncture needle that's like stuck very accurately into the place where zazen gets off track by limiting it in some way. Where, you know, acupuncture is very like unblocking our stuck energy channels. If there's some stuck place, as my limited understanding of acupuncture is like that, and they put a needle in right at that meridian of that channel, and it kind of like unblocks the energy, and you can even feel the energy kind of spreading out. So this is, again, a poetic name of this poem and this essay for putting in this medicinal needle at the blocked point of our understanding of zazen to kind of open it up. So Hongzhi's poem I won't read the whole poem because it could become a whole other class. But it ends with these lines: the water is clear to the bottom, a fish is swimming slowly, slowly. The sky is infinitely vast, a bird is flying far, far away. After it's talking about the mind of zazen, he puts in this poetic image about fish and birds moving through the vast sphere that they're in. And then Dogen, in his Zazen Xin essay, comments on each line of this poem. So when he gets down to these final two lines, verses of the poem here, of Hongzhi's verses, Dogen says, if you're following this, right, this is Dogen's Zazen Xin essay, but it's very similar to the Genjo Koan, commenting on water and air. So it seems clarifying to bring this up at this point. Dogen says, as to the meaning of the water is clear, water suspended in space is not thoroughly clear to the bottom. This water in Hongzhi's verse is not the clean water that's deep and clear in the external world. So this is not just like the water that we usually see as water, like clean, clear water that we usually see. This water that has no boundary, no bank or shore, is thoroughly clear to the bottom. So in this verse, the water we're talking about is the water with no edges or boundaries, like the vast ocean, totally clear, ungraspable because it has no color or shape or edges. And the sky is like this too. And then picturing this vast, spacious, clear realm, in the middle of that is a little bird or fish, like a... On the cover of the book here, there's this little tiny fish in this, you know, vast space of blue. Right? That's like us swimming in Zazen. The practitioner is like the of Zazen, or of the practitioner of life. If we widen it beyond sitting meditation practice, we could say life is like this vast ocean field with no edges, like the sky or water, and there's little us in the midst of it. In this case, the clear, vast spaces of life includes like all these things, very complicated things that we're swimming through, negotiating our complicated life, but it has no edges, and the complications have no edges. I think at one point my teacher said, another way to look at this metaphor is the air and the water are like confusion. So Buddhas swim through this vast, spacious, unhindered ocean, and sentient beings, us practitioners, swim through confusion. That's our realm, and it has no end, no edges of confusion, and kind of complications and so on. We swim through that, but can we, as a practice, swim through confusion in a free, unhindered way? This would be like Dogen's Zazen. So Dogen goes on about Hongjer, saying, when a fish goes through this water, we cannot say that there's no movement. Although the fish migrates more than 10,000 miles, its movement cannot be measured, and it's unlimited. There's no bank on the shore from which to survey it. There's no air into which the fish might break the surface and, jump out to look back down at the water. Fish might jump sometimes, but, they're in the air for such a short time, they can't really check out the water from the air. And there's no bottom to which the fish might sink. Therefore, there's no one who can measure it, the edges of this ocean. If we want to discuss its measurements, we say only that the water is thoroughly clear to the bottom, which is the line in the poem. The virtue of Zazen is like the fish swimming. Even though we may progress in our sitting 1,000 or 10,000 miles, who can estimate it? The process of going that thoroughly penetrates to the bottom, that it penetrates to the bottom. And that's the whole body is not flying the way of the birds, which is, as Dogen is often doing, he starts referencing these other Zen sayings. And this is a saying of Dongshan about, basically the gist of it is not, the bird and their track, the bird's track, are not separate. And the bird and the sky are not separate. Everything and the bird flying in the sky and the fish swimming in the water, we can't separate them. We can't leave the realm of the water and air. And similarly with the sky. So to go back to the Genjo Koan now, so when their activity is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. This is with no judgment about the large or small or better or worse. It's just the interdependence of the practitioner and the practice that they're swimming in. It's like there's a perfect correspondence every moment with all of us. Thus, each of them totally covers its full range, and each of them totally experiences its realm. If the bird leaves the air, it will die at once. If the fish leaves the water, it will die at once. If the practitioner leaves the practice, it will die at once. So this is like the, if we're saying practice is life, we can't leave this, the realm that we're swimming in. We're completely interdependent with it. And you could say that is death, actually, when we leave this boundless world that we're swimming in. That's the end of life. And if we're just talking about sitting meditation, if we leave that that boundless awareness, then the Zazen person dies at once and becomes a walking meditation person, or becomes a getting in the car person, and then there's the boundless world of like riding in the car, which also has no edges. Know that water is life and air is life. The bird is life and the fish is life. And then in reverse, life must be the bird and life must be the fish. It is possible to illustrate this with more analogies. Practice enlightenment and people are like this. So if we say that the bird and the fish are the practitioner, the water and the air are the practice that they're swimming in, we could say that life is the verification of freedom. And so for people that haven't been to these earlier classes, Dogen's classic descriptions of practice or of meditation is what he calls practice and verification. Practice and verification are not two. I think in this translation they say practice enlightenment of the Buddha way. But more literally, practice and verification or confirmation. So water is life, so practice is verification. And verification is practice. They're not separate ever. And there's the practice and the verification, and then we throw in the bird or the fish, which is the person swimming in the sea of practice and verification. They're swimming. Is practice, and the swimming is also verifying the freedom of swimming. But it's actually has to be swimming or has to be flying. It's not like they can stop and kind of check out the water, or these images that Dogen says of like leaping out of the water, like let's look down and see if we can verify the practice that's going on down there. Like we're in it completely. There's no separating ourselves from the sphere that we're in to like step outside and check ourselves, or verify ourselves. In other words, we can't ever verify ourselves. We can't confirm our own practice. We can't confirm our own freedom. As soon as we do, we die at once. we leave the realm where we're actually just practicing. We create a separation if we were to leave the sphere of practice in order to check out if it is verifying freedom. If we have to leave in order to do that, we can't. We would die. In other words, the practice would stop. Can you follow this a little bit? It's a funny way of talking. Practice and verification cannot be separated at all. And so, like, in both ways. So to step outside the practice in order to verify it is to, like, step outside the ocean as a fish. Or to step outside the verification to try to do some practice, which is an even weirder idea. It would be the same thing. No separation. This is a weird way of talking, but I think Dogen is kind of a weird guy. Can I ask anything about this? Yeah.
Are you saying you can't do it, or that if we do it,
We can't do the verification by stepping outside it of practice to look back on it. We can step outside of practice to try to verify it, but we won't be it won't be the verification that is one with the practice.
What would be an example of trying to step outside of practice to verify
it? I think when we were sitting zazen, this may be an example. We're sitting zazen and we're just sitting in the present. We're just sitting in the present. We're just sitting in the present. And we're just sitting in the present. And we're very settled, and we have some sense maybe that we're in the midst of a vast ocean. And then we want to check. We want to. And we have some sense maybe that there's some freedom here. And then we think, wasn't there something about Dogen talking about the freedom of zazen? And like, let's check to see if we are. And then it's almost like in our mind we kind of like leave that realm of just sitting in the present, and kind of the mind kind of steps, a little part of the mind kind of steps outside. Let's check this out. And that's kind of like we've left the swimming, the inconceivable swimming in the ocean, in order to like check it, verify it from outside, which would be like, then practice and verification would be split apart. It'd be the practice, and there'd be like a little part of me outside myself looking back and trying to verify. Does that example make sense? And I think this is not uncommon, right? We probably all have that experience during meditation, maybe quite frequently. And it's kind of like, it's sometimes excruciating to not do that, isn't it? People that have a zazen practice, they're sitting and it's fine, and that we can't stand that it's just fine. We want to like make sure that it's fine. We want to like check for sure or something like this. We want to, as Dogen says earlier, we want to carry the self forward and verify the myriad things. From outside the myriad things. You know, instead of like being completely interdependently arising and ceasing with or as the myriad things. Rather than the myriad things themselves coming forth, verifying this moment of zazen, which is the case all the time. Myriad things are coming forth and verifying, and we've talked about this some past weeks, about myriad things are confirming us in this way. Verifying or confirming, meaning like they're making us. The whole universe is creating us every moment without us doing anything about it. And to just be swimming or floating in the midst of that realm is sometimes excruciating, because in a way, almost like the more we're just completely immersed in that, the more excruciating it is to not step outside and a little bit and say, like, just ask, how am I doing? Ask ourselves. Very, very quietly. We sometimes, right, the fish that we are, sometimes, well, let's just take a little jump up above the water surface, just a little peek. But, you know, as soon as we, like, are above the surface, it's like we're not in the water. And then splash, we're back in the water, and we have no idea what's going on anymore. Yeah.
I'm looking at a couple of other translations.
Oh, yeah.
Something. One of them says, in this way, no creature ever fails to realize its own completeness. Wherever it is, it functions freely. And this is from Cook. And another one says something quite similar. Therefore, they realize full function in each thing, and free ability according to each place.
Hmm.
Those, to me, reveal something about the reality manifesting itself. And then, if we look at a later paragraph and see, although actualized immediately, the inconceivable may not be distinctly apparent. Its appearance is beyond your knowledge. In a way, this is what you're getting at, that it is impossible to be aware or self-reflective in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we kind of have to step out of our inconceivable being to reflect on. Yes, and there are, and Dogen will play with these ideas, that if we realize that we never really can step out of the ocean, that then even the stepping out is part of the ocean, right? But this gets tricky, because if we, you know, so at the moment of stepping out, and maybe then the disappointment of like looking back and like, where was it? I was just there, and now we're looking back. Where did it go? Where did the ocean go? We're in the air for a moment. Where did the ocean go? And then we remember that actually that very asking, oh, where did the ocean go? And the disappointment of being outside, feeling like we're outside the ocean, is actually still in the ocean. This is the deeper subtlety of this, is we can never really escape. I mean, the bird or the fish will die at once, but actually, ultimately, it's impossible to leave this realm. But Dogen's not getting into that at this point. He's just saying, it's kind of like, if you think that you can step outside the ocean, you'll die. You'll appear to die. If you think that you can step out of anything of your, you know, of your life, then it will be difficult. It will be a struggle. But actually, we can't, really. Even when we, what we call physically die, we're not stepping out of Genjo Koan. But the problem is when we think we do, we think we can, or we think we have, then we suffer.
What I wonder is this. I mean, it seems like I make choices, change career, in a relationship, out of a relationship, in one place, in another place. And it is kind of like, in some ways, I think I see myself as a fish jumping out of one pond and into another. And there is suffering. You know, it's like life as I knew it ended. And there's loss that goes with any, even if it's something really new and exciting, there's letting go of what was. And that there's suffering in that.
Yeah, and that they're not really two different oceans.
No, I'm still me.
Yeah.
Same fish.
Yeah.
Swimming in the still work and still love and still.
Yeah. You were in one harbor, and then you just like swim around the, you know, through this maybe narrow river or something into another harbor, but it's still all the same water. And I think that's helpful to know that it's all the same water, and that we're, but it's continuously changing, and we can't see the edges of it. It's not like something really ended, or something really began. Like earlier, Dogen says, we don't call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. It's like each thing is just complete in the moment.
And maybe a way to check that desire to get felt, to validate, you know, am I doing this right?
Mm-hmm.
Think it through and realize, well, I'm still going to be the fish, just, you know, just moved around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still the fish, and we're coursing through the practice of our life. And life must be the fish. The verification must be the practice. At this Nishiari Bokusan, this is a Suzuki Roshi's, one of Suzuki Roshi's teachers. So we have his commentary and the part about if the fish leaves the air, it leaves the water, it will die at once. Bird leaves the sky, will air will die at once. He says, he quotes this line that we do at the end of our formal meals in Sashin. We say, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. And he says, if we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus, we will not be bound by the world, the world of birth and death. There's nothing lacking in this world of birth and death, as this is the settled abode of the Buddha. The Buddha dies when he's outside of this world. We die when we get outside the water of true empty nature. So here he's saying water is like the true empty nature, which is not separate from the world as we know it. So this verse, abiding, may we exist in the muddy water of the world of birth and death with purity like a lotus. And I always find that it's a nice verse to chant at the end of a meal, because orioki, this formal kind of eating style that we do in retreats, it's kind of messy. It's kind of muddy it's all this like very detailed stuff that we're doing. Some people might say it looks very refined, and it's like the opposite of a messy meal, but actually to try to like do it all, to try to do all these forms of eating that way, it's kind of like a little bit chaotic and messy. And it's just like, or even if you get it to the point of where it's really refined and everything's just flowing perfectly smoothly, still it's like we're just like eating this food and spilling it, and you know, even to just be eating food is a kind of messy situation. So I think it's not unintentional that at the end of like this very earthy human thing we do called eating, we say, now may we exist in this muddy water of having a meal with purity like a lotus. Like, we need to eat. We need to live in this world. And but may it be in this way with purity like a lotus. And I think that doesn't mean to do it really carefully and to not spill our food. I don't think it means, that's not what purity would mean here. It would mean like that this very messy thing of having a meal in the first place is completely pure. There's that image in Buddhism of the lotus appears over and over again. There's a lotus sutra, and the idea is that the lotuses grow in the mud, and they need really like earthy kind of mud at the bottom of the water, and then out of the mud comes this this stalk of lotus, and then it comes up above the water and sprouts and perfectly pure, unmuddy lotus, but it's like growing out of the mud. And then it like pops out all these seeds, and that they sink back down into the mud and grow more lotuses. So that image, I think, is quite wonderful. The purity is right in the middle of the growing out of the mud. So may we exist in the muddy water and with purity, like a lotus does. And I think that's what this is referring to here, is not leaving the air and the water. If we leave the world, the muddy world of eating meals, for example, we will die at once, quite literally in that case. We might think, oh, that's if we really refine our practice, we could just like live on air. And there's these Zen stories about how some of the Zen ancestors got to this point. They were living out in the mountains, and they're like, actually, my zazen is so deep that like I actually don't need to be, I don't need to actually eat anymore. And then like spirits would feed them, like kind of invisible spirit food to keep them alive. And then some teacher would usually come correct them and say, this is off, this shouldn't be happening like this. And so then they find that real zazen that's like completely one with the world. It's not like transcending the world. It's like completely swimming in the midst of their own birth and death, the muddy world that they're in. And then the spirits can't find them again. Spirits can't feed them anymore, and they start eating regular food. These are some of the kind of weirder stories of Zen ancestors.
Don't hungry ghosts need like scraps of food and left things dribble off our chins? They won't eat just regular food.
Mm.
They only eat sort of...
According to their karmic situation, it seems like they, kind of strange food. And they like things like uncooked rice. And, yeah, they're quirky. So then we go on to water's life and air's life, the bird is life and the fish is life. Life must be the bird, and so on. Okay, so now we're down to the next paragraph. Now, if a bird or a fish tries to reach the end of its element before moving in it, this bird or this fish will not find its way or its place. And interestingly, the other translations, so this says, you know, before moving in it. The other ones all say after. And I'm like, this is weird. But actually, the meaning ends up being the same. So, like, another translation would be, would be like, if a fish or birds tried to move only through the water or sky, only after thoroughly comprehending it, they would not find their way or their place in the water or sky. So this our translation here says, before moving in, it means if they try to if they try to, you know, reach the end of it, it means like if they try to totally fill their realm of practice. Before moving in it means like before swimming completely. You know, if they try to imaginarily reach the end, or for example, we could say, try to reach Buddhahood without practicing. We could say it's like reach the end of this element of water before swimming, which would be just like living our life, or some idea, some conceptual idea of what that would be without actually just living this. Then it's impossible to reach. And I think that's the same sense as he's saying, if the fish or birds try to move through the water or sky only after thoroughly comprehending it, they would not find their way or its place. And this seems to refer to, most commentaries agree, that it's the thing of like, we're not going to start practicing until we understand what it is. Which is a common thing that is actually, I think that's very normal. It's again another excruciating thing sometimes to feel like, well, I haven't really clarified what zazen is, and I'm not just going to go like sit in that room and until I understand what it is. You know, so please explain it, or like, I got to read about this before I sit down. And there's no end to that kind of thinking. We can keep clarifying it, but we have to actually just sit down and practice. Like, this is the sense of it. So for people who may be coming new and thinking like, if what you're saying is zazen, then I'm not going to practice this because this sounds like outrageous and ridiculous what you're talking about. And I don't deny that this sounds outrageous and ridiculous, but in the end, it's all about like we just have to sit down and in the muddy water of our life and just start swimming. Just start swimming. Or like if somebody said, well, you know, they're learning literally to swim. It's like, well, teach me all the like strokes and everything and exactly how I'm going to stay afloat. Or riding a bike or something, right? When you're teaching a kid to ride a bike, you can't just explain it. You say, well, there are things to say about riding the bike, but first, just get on the seat here. I'm going to hold on to the back and just start pedaling and go. But what do I do? And, you know, for those who learn to ride a bike with your parents, maybe, often there's that experience and like, but I don't even know what to do. And pretty soon, like, don't let go. And then you look back and mom or dad is like way back down the road. Why you let go? I mean, I'm actually just riding. And then crash. Sometimes crash, you know. And then we get on again and keep trying. And then in the midst of this, it's not to deny that there aren't instructions about Zazen, because that's what all this is about in its own weird way. But it's like it doesn't even make sense maybe without actually starting to swim or fly in whatever way we can do that. And in a way, it's like we're already doing that, but it's like agreeing to take that up, agreeing to admit that we're already like in our life and we've already started. don't start my life yet, wait till I'm ready. I mean, it's easy to think this way too. Hold on a second. And then we, like I was preparing for class, I'm like, there's not enough time to do this, there's so much more to go through. And it's like, it's time for class. We're going to do it now. We're going to just swim in the midst of this, and it's going to be messy because there's a lot more we could have clarified first. But let's do it. And that's really the spirit of Zen, is just go ahead and do it, and then we'll keep clarifying, and we're doing this together. We're swimming in the muddy water and clarifying the muddy water together. Or another translation is if there were birds or fish who attempted to cross the waters or sky after having found the limits of the water or sky, they wouldn't find a path in it. Or if they wanted to go through the sky or water if there were a bird or fish that wanted to go through the sky or water after studying it thoroughly, it could in sky or water make no path. And then when you find your place where you are, is that where we are? Yes. Practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. So this is the first place the title appears in full. The title of Genjo Koan is translated as actualizing the fundamental point. After all this description, when you find your place where you are, practice occurs, which is Genjo Koan, actualizing the fundamental point. When you find your way at this moment, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. And the it doesn't show up in any of these translations, but the Chinese characters here, actually, it's this word onri, which means not just practice in terms of like Zazen practice, but like means like daily life or daily activity, or daily deeds.
Which of these words is what you're translating?
The
word says practice occurs?
It would be the part of practice occurs. Mm-hmm. Practice, the word practice there is this kind of unique word that means practice, but like daily activity, you could say. And I think that's a wonderful nuance of the meaning there, because it's not just talking about meditation practice. It's saying, you know, our daily life, just the normal activities of daily life. When you find your place at this moment, find your way at this moment, our daily activities just occur as they do, actualizing the fundamental point. Or we could say, when you find your way at this moment, our daily life actualizes the fundamental point. Our daily activities manifest ultimate truth. That would be another translation. And this is like, I think, you know, all this can sound so complicated when we're talking about it, but this is one of these sentences where it seems like it's very simple. Just when we find our place, this moment, find our way right now, basically just return to the present and relax into this the muddy ocean that we're in. Suddenly, like our momentary activity, this moment, manifests complete reality. Different translations for Gendo Koan are like, the actualized universe. It's one of them, kind of loose translation of Koan, the actualization of the universal and every particular completely combined. That's manifested each moment. Just finding our way at this moment, finding a place where we are, and not finding a place somewhere else, but just right here, always just returning right here. Very simple. You could say, well, what does this mean? But there's infinite depth to what it means, and yet it's also very simple. It's just letting go of all our extra ideas of how to do this moment. Your question?
Oh, I just had a thought about the size of the circle.
Mm.
That you see in the middle of the ocean.
Yes.
How big or how small it's really. Because where we find ourselves actualizing the fundamental point in our lives, all we can see is what it's very small compared to the universe.
Hmm.
You know,
mm.
It's just my life around me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. Like that. And it's kind of like the ocean. I mean, as opposed to it just being what your zazen is like.
Yeah.
But we can't see that. It's
infinitely
complex. But that doesn't mean we're limited to our own experience as far as our comprehension, and that's all. It's possible.
Mm-hmm. And yes. And we kind of know on some level that includes everything.
Right.
Yeah.
It includes everything, even what we can't see.
That's a beautiful point to bring this sentence back to the earlier part about the circle of ocean. Yeah, because it's, well, our daily life activities are manifesting the entire universe. Like, wait a second. So I think this is a good point that, it's like we're in the midst of the ocean. We only see this circle of water, and yet we know that the other features of oceans are infinite variety. Whole worlds are there. And it's more like we trust that that's so in the interdependence of everything that, we're part of the whole. And I think we all have this experience sometimes. I think we know this. This is a complicated, poetic way of saying when we just relax into the present for a moment, or just walking down the street, or in zazen, or in the car, or whatever, we just when we're just here for a moment, we're open to some extent to the boundlessness of this universe that we're in. We feel connected. And I think we have this sense of that, and that we feel like a part of a larger whole, just naturally. And Dogen's pointing out how that's always the case. We are always connected like this, but we're not in touch with it so much because we're not paying attention to that wider ocean. We're focusing on whether it's good enough, whether we like it or not, or yeah, is this really okay? And we're just, our discriminating mind is basically just constantly assessing the situation, which kind of narrows our circle.
At the same time, he says that the way is neither large nor small.
Mm.
So this idea of dimensionality perhaps doesn't come into play somehow.
Mm. Yeah, so that's the next part. For the place, the way is neither large nor small, neither yours nor others. The place, the way, has not carried over from the past, and it's not merely arising now. It's beyond all these you know, dualistic constructs of large and small, comparative mind, and judgments of this or that. You know, it's kind of just saying, maybe just a summary for different opposites. It's not big, it's not small, it's not yours, it's not others, it's not red, it's not green, it's not bad or good, it's not painful or pleasant, it's not what's supposed to be happening or what's not supposed to be happening. It's just this. It's just the place, the way, where we find ourselves right now. And as we talked about in previous sections, this Dharma position, the particular location of this body and mind in the midst of the interdependent universe. We're dependent on everything creating this body and mind experience right now. And it's completely particular to each of us is completely, I keep trying to avoid the word unique, because we say that means maybe separate. Not separate, but special in a way.
Particular.
Particular. Very particular. Just, you know, this. And completely interconnected at the same time. So this kind of theme runs through lots of Buddha Dharma. That kind of intersection of universal, in, you know, oneness or emptiness where nothing can be seen, the dark, ungraspable, unknowing, and completely not separate from each individual particular thing, all dependent on all the other particular things. That both of those ways of viewing our life are not separate at all. They're just two different ways of viewing it. So even when we're very like caught up and really like in anguish over some particular problem of our life, at that very same time, there's this large ocean that we're in, that particular problem is being you know, created by everything in this miraculous way. But we're focused on like this shouldn't be happening, and it's actually really painful. So I think a lot of these teachings are about we're just hearing this again and again that we're actually in this larger ocean, and then remembering that. And I think we know in our deepest experience that it is the case. So then, in the midst of our anguish over some particular problem of our life, we can in the back of our mind this. The moon is shining through. It's reminding us that it's not limited to this story that we have at the moment.
In that context, could you say a little bit about the word transcendence?
Hmm.
For me, that word is always a little problematic.
Did it come up in here? Or
no, but you said it maybe a paragraph of speech or so ago.
Hmm. Transcend. I don't remember how I used it, but transcending, it can be a problematic word, because it's like transcend. If we talk about transcending the world, it often means, I think if we use that word, it tends to imply that we're going beyond the world. We're like rejecting the world. We're there's a realm that's like outside of our problems, where they, you know, that that's the real world, something like that, and it's split off from our daily life activities, and that understanding of transcendence would be off because it just makes it split. Whereas there's this word that Dogen often uses, is like going beyond, and sometimes it's translated as transcending, but how is it? Koji, it's like going above or beyond, and he often uses it to refer to Buddha. He's got an essay called Going Beyond Buddha, and sometimes it might get translated as transcending Buddha, but what it might mean, if we are going to use the word transcend, I think we could use it in this way of going beyond or transcending could be basically letting go of our current ideas of the situation, and then at one moment of letting go of a current story or version of some situation, our experience goes beyond that limited story version, but we're still like in our life, and now we maybe even have a new story, a going beyond story, and then we go beyond that. So, as I've brought this up before, but I think it's one of the great descriptions of what I call enlightenment in Dogen's teaching. One of his many descriptions is this term going beyond Buddha, which means, as he describes it, letting go of our current ideas of Buddha. And that, you know, then we go beyond that, it's kind of going beyond our limited understanding. And maybe we could say transcending our limited understanding, but then we're just in another understanding. And then we let go of that, and that goes beyond. And so going beyond Buddha is a continual process. There's not like an end point. In Dogen's version of enlightenment, it's not like a place that you get to, and that's the end. His enlightenment, or Buddha, what Buddha, or enlightenment, awakening, means is going beyond our current version of Buddha, our current understanding, but not just once, but continuously going beyond. I don't know if that touches it a little bit.
It does get at it, but it also seems like the conditions of us having a limited understanding are contained within this so-called beyond.
Our conditions for having the limited understanding are contained in the going beyond. Yeah, the conditions never disappear, something like that. The lotus is always in the mud. Another translation of that meal chant is abiding in this. This is the current San Francisco translation. We say, abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. It's the same characters, I think. Goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. So it's like abiding in this impermanent, fleeting world. Like we don't go into this realm of permanent, pure Buddhahood. That's what we mean by the mind is pure and goes beyond. Means abiding in this ephemeral world. The mind is pure and goes beyond. So yeah, the conditions for our limited understanding are still right here, but we go beyond our current understanding of those conditions even. And so you could say actually the conditions could be changing continuously, but our understanding is always limited, and that's one of the points that Will went through Genjo Koan too, is that it's there's no end, and this point that was made about when Dharma fills your whole body and mind, you understand that something's missing. When Dharma does not fill your body and mind, you think it's already sufficient. So when really Dharma filling body and mind is like we're swimming in the ocean completely, and at that time we see that, it has to do with this circle of ocean part too, that we see that we can't ever see the whole picture here. But we can still, we have our, whatever we're holding on to as our limited idea of what's happening now, we can let go of that. That's all we can do in terms of practice. But letting go of it doesn't mean like everything disappears and we're suddenly like nothing's happening. We get a new set of conditions. Maybe another way to say it is there's always conditions, but they're always changing. So we let go of holding on to a certain set of conditions, and then going beyond that means we're immediately given a whole bunch more conditions. And then going beyond that would be like letting go of our limited view of those conditions, and then we'll get more. And it's not necessarily like this is even improving. It's just letting go of the current holding, whatever that is.
So now we have kind of layers looking at, like if we look at kind of a cognitive intellectual understanding, that's one perfectly valid, and then we might have the other five senses involved, and we might call that perception. So an intellectual understanding is included within perception, and perception could be said to be included within absolute reality, even though the intellect is so far beyond what the intellect can do. It's so far beyond what conceptual thought can handle. And yet, the underlying reality continues to be there, whether there's an intellectual awareness of it or not, or whether there's even perceptual awareness of it or not.
The underlying reality being,
I guess Suzuki Roshi would call it things as it is.
Yeah, or we could say like in this, the or Genjo Koan, right? That, you know, the manifestation of everything. Interdependently and inconceivably arising is going on, whether we have any understanding of that or not.
The ocean.
The ocean.
It seems so. I think I get tripped up with the word transcendence, because for me it's more like immersion.
That's nice, yeah.
In the story of the fifth ancestor, the student is given the task to write a poem. He writes a poem of the mirror on the stand and the tree. And he reaches a certain consciousness which then the fifth ancestor reads, and he says, there is no tree, there is no mirror, so how can dust ever land? I feel that's transcending. You have to reach a certain level of consciousness and learn of this tree and mirror and dust in order to realize there is nothing at all. In the same way that a tree, or if a fish goes from one harbor to another harbor, not realizing because it's only his perception, and like you said, there's our reality, but there's so much more. There's another harbor we're unaware of. If fish is water, if fish is life, and water is life, are they both the same? Then this reality and transcending, it's pretty much the same consciousness, but just a different level of it. So I'm getting, then I guess transcending is, sounds more like unity to me.
Unity of
the fish in the water, myself and life, everything that's going on around me, whether it's positive or negative. It's really just going on.
That's a nice way to put it, I think, that transcendence is unity of all things. And then why use the word transcendence, but you could say it's going beyond our view of non-unity or something. And Jean's way of saying it was, rather than, you said full immersion, was that the word? Yeah, like which sounds opposite, but I think it's same thing. That's when we're in this kind of realm. That's the beauty of it, is I think it can be described from these opposite kind of words, but they're actually the same experience. And the thing about, you know, there's polishing the mirror, and then there's the other poem about there's no place for the dust to land. We could see those two, also the unity of those two, that actually there's, in one sense, there's no place for dust to land, and in another sense, it's like there's the manifestation of a mirror and dust in the muddy water realm where lotuses grow. There's it's the actually mud is little specks of dust, like a sea of mud, muddy dust. There is that, and that understanding is not separate from the understanding that there actually isn't any dust. And this is the realm of like the Heart Sutra. And, you know, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And we can talk about transcendence is immersion, and immersion is transcendence. All these words that are just spinning around and playing with the inconceivable. I think that's what Dogen's doing, and I think in our discussion it's so wonderful to like bring up all the different angles on this and see how different words can turn us too. So it's like if we're transcendence is sending us into an ethereal, leaving the world kind of space, then at that time we need to say full immersion and boom, find our place where we are, right here. And if we're getting like, if we're feeling like stuck somehow in a fixed view of our narrow little limited place, then we can say go beyond, and we like, you know, leap clear of a fixed position or something like that. Yes, Kathy. Oh, go ahead.
May come from the tradition of how philosophy is taught in the West, regarding our ideas of maybe the divine or some desirable destination. It's often posed in terms of, well, this tradition stresses immanence or immersion, whereas that tradition stresses transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
But I've not, heard the possibility of one moving into the other in the way that we've just been discussing. It was generally set up as an either-or situation. And so, no wonder we have a little difficulty with this.
Yeah. Yeah, both sides. And I think particularly Dogen in general, and the Genjo Koan in particular, is emphasizing the, you might call it, immanence side, or the full immersion side, actually more, because it's talking, the very title, Genjo Koan, is talking about actualizing or manifesting the fundamental point. It's about a here and now coming to be, an actualization. It's not, he could have called it transcending the non-fundamental point, or even transcending the fundamental point, but no, it's actualizing, manifesting, making real, immanentizing the fundamental point, this interdependent arising of everything. Yeah, Kathy?
Well, I think that, when I'm struggling with this issue, I think our focus points can shift. I'm thinking like foreground, background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, And I'm thinking of this drawing that I've seen where it's drawn in such a way that if you focus on the black, you see one thing. And if you focus on the white space, you see another thing.
The two faces in the vase.
And then there's also a cube that I've seen. And, I mean, it's the same in what we're talking about. Like you were just saying, you know, if you're fixating too much on the particular, then maybe you do need to transcend. You know, and if you're fixating too much on the big and the vast, then you're forgetting, you know, then you fall on your face and you hit a rock, you know, and you need to remember the particular.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it's all the same. It's the same world.
Yeah.
And we get stuck because this is the better lens.
Mm-hmm.
My lens is the right lens. And I'm remembering this is something that a teacher said. It was at the Soto Shu Sashin. There's a tongue twister. Years ago that I at Tassajara when I was there, and it was this teacher who talked about how look up, you know, this teaching of like in Yosemite Valley, and you're walking along and you're all obsessing about your life and you're talking with your friends and you're thinking about your problems and it's like, look up, you know, and I've always remembered that feeling of like just in any moment you can shift focus. But I would say sometimes look up and probably sometimes it's look down.
Yeah, definitely. And Zen, the Zen tradition, I think, of all different presentations of Buddhism, my feeling right now is that Zen most magnificently plays with this very principle of like the vast open wide sky and the particular, the universal and the particular and their relationship in very creative ways. And that's what the koan stories are mostly about, like the classic things of, you know, what is, you know, the ultimate intention of Buddhism, or why did Bodhidharma come from the West, and, you know, the cypress tree in the garden, or, you know, what it's like bringing this universal question of like, it's like, you know, expecting him to say like, total emptiness, no limits to anything. No, just like the cypress tree in the garden. And then if somebody's fixated on the cypress tree in the garden, we say the cypress tree goes beyond itself or in its cypress tree-ness. So that back and forth. And the emphasis on Zen, and like the mind of boundlessness, and at the same time paying attention to all these details of the forms and particulars of how we sit and so on. When you attain your place here, everyday activity naturally becomes the realization of the koan. It's another translation. When you attain your way now, everyday activity naturally is the realization koan. When one finds this place, this action accordingly manifests as the issue at hand. When one finds this path, this action accordingly manifests as the issue at hand. These are other translations. So, accordingly, in the practice enlightenment of the Buddha way, meeting one thing is mastering it, doing one practice is practicing completely. So, in the practice verification of the Buddha way, meeting one thing is mastering it, doing one practice is practicing completely. Or, attaining one Dharma is penetrating one Dharma, and encountering one activity is practicing one activity. So this also goes back to this thing of when you see forms or hear sounds, fully engaging body and mind, you grasp things directly. It's like, again, just this is real like practice instructions, really straightforward. You could just say, just do one thing completely and everything is included there. Very simple, and like to try to understand it makes it complicated. But in its heart, it's very straightforward, but simple doesn't mean easy, right? It's actually very difficult because we're so used to not doing one thing or thinking we're doing many things, multitasking. You know, this multitasking would be the opposite of what we call one practice samadhi. And it's the same way, doing one practice, practicing completely. So there's this term one practice samadhi that the sixth ancestor brings up that we'll get to in the Platform Sutra. And I think in there he says, what is one practice samadhi? Samadhi means, you know, concentration in meditation. It is straightforward mind at all times. Something like this. Or do it, and this would be Dogen's take on it, just doing one practice completely. Again, I think it's not something so complicated. One practice. And Bokusan's commentary on this section is, this being so, if you engage one dharma, you should penetrate that dharma. There's no need to hurry, no need to get another dharma or another practice. When you eat rice, you should become rice. When you do zazen, you should become zazen thoroughly. Now he's got a little thing about koan study here, because he's emphasizing the just sitting part. So just become zazen thoroughly. Just become sitting in this posture. There's no need to bring in the koans. If you work on koans during zazen, the koan becomes the master and zazen becomes the attendant. Thus, zazen is no longer zazen. To abide at ease in steadfast non-thinking is the bullseye of zazen. When we talk about zazen in the realm of thoroughly experiencing one dharma, invariably myriad dharmas arise all together, study together, and practice simultaneously. So even though there's one practice, one dharma, but everything's actually included, the same point about the universal in particular. Although this is not recognized, in fact there is simultaneous arising and simultaneous studying together. All other dharmas and all other practices are merged in darkness and practice in darkness. This is to practice together with the entire universe and to practice together with all sentient beings. If we look at this text in this way, not distinct means not to be known. Oh, the next lines here. That's right. The boundary of realization is not distinct, for the realization comes forth simultaneously with the mastery of Buddha Dharma. The Dharma that is not to be known comes forth simultaneously with the mastery of Buddha Dharma. If we understand in this way, it's completely all right that what is to be known is not known. So he's having some fun here with these words. And there's a verse, encountering spring year after year, the heart does not change, which is this line from this poem, Living Out in the Mountains. And he says, spring after spring, the heart doesn't change. Like, he's not moved by the magnificence of spring. That's how it's usually taken, is like, you know, I'm just like sitting here as the seasons go by and by in the mountains, and when the exuberance of spring comes, my heart is still. As a practice thing, but he says, Bokusan here says, in regards to this section, does the heart not changing mean that sprouts do not come forth from a decayed tree or flowers do not bloom? No, it doesn't. To sprout in spring is the heart that does not change. Which is a little bit like some of the things Gene was bringing up. It's like about transcendence. We might think,
like transcendence
to say that the heart doesn't change when the magnificence of spring comes, sounds like we've gone beyond
the nature of spring.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he's clarifying that by saying it doesn't mean that. The sprout in spring is the heart that does not change. That's a nice line, I think. To bloom in spring is to abide at ease immovably. And then this is a quote from something. I have great power, which is that I fall down when a storm blows. I have the power to fall down when a storm blows. I mean, instead of like, I have the power to like resist any storm, or the power to not be moved in spring, I have the power to bloom in spring. Because you abide at the place of no abiding, your mind is at ease. When you thoroughly exhaust one practice after another at this place of ease, each practice is the path of unsurpassed awakening, which arises and is practiced simultaneously with thorough actualization of Buddha Dharma. A lot of ado about nothing. Any final comments before we close this section? We have one more class on the Genjo Koan next week, and then we'll have a sesshin and end the practice period. And so the last class is the capping story about fanning the wind. And we have the sesshin coming, which is a time to actualize the fundamental point in this unique, particular way of Dogen Zen, that we express not express blooming in the midst of non-doing in Zazen. May all beings swim freely in the ocean of Genjo Koan. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow.